For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911, now reopened for in-store shopping on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 11 till 5, Saturdays from 10 to 4. Don't forget your mask. And you can still shop online at jackanddrea.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Baseball fans, we have a great treat for you today. But I hasten to add that even if you are not a huge fan of the game of baseball or interested in baseball history, there is still a really fascinating story at the heart of a brand new book called Dalco, The Untold Story of Baseball's Fastest Pitcher. There are baseball fans who certainly still know the name of Steve Dalkowski, even though Steve Dalkowski had a career that was decades old. I mean, a long time ago was Steve Dalkowski on baseball diamonds. And although a professional baseball player, he only pitched in the minor leagues. But he was a legend. Even as a high schooler, he was something of a legend. And he is thought of as baseball's all-time fastest pitcher. Unfortunately, he had a lot of issues when it came to matters of control and getting strikes when the chips were down or when the stakes were high. So there are ways in which he was not successful by many standard benchmarks, but he was a very powerful and incredible talent. And his story is a really striking one on so many levels. So this is a deeply human story in addition to being a really interesting baseball story as well. And I thoroughly enjoyed this book very, very much. The book is co-authored by three gentlemen, Bill Dembski, Alex Thomas, and my morning show guest, Brian Vikander, who is actually a very, very well-known baseball pitching coach. And he has focused most of his professional time and energies in that pursuit for the last several decades. And he counts a number of successful baseball pitchers, including professional baseball pitchers, among his clients. He's also a talented photojournalist who has done work for, among others, the National Geographic and the New York Times. He is one of the three authors of this really interesting book, which is again called Dalco, The Untold Story of Baseball's Fastest Pitcher. And the book is published by Influence. Brian Vikander, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, a pleasure to be with you and have an opportunity to talk about Dalkowski. Thank you so much.
Before we get into the book, I think it would be interesting for our listeners to know a little bit more about you and your own background, and in particular, your own connection to the game of baseball, even ahead of becoming such a successful pitching coach. I am assuming, I would assume, that growing up you were a baseball player and that baseball was really important to you for from an early age. Tell us more.
Yeah, absolutely it was. And as a little leaguer is when I first heard about Dalkowski pitching up in Stockton. As a little leaguer, I knew all 16 major league teams, but I wasn't sure about what the minor leagues really were. Sounds stupid today, but at the time, we didn't know. And we heard about Dalkowski. A few months later, my dad's reading Time magazine, and he says, "Is this the guy you've been talking about all this time?" "I think it is, Dad. I mean, we didn't have papers talking about it." I've been following Dalco for 60 years. Every time there was a snippet out there on what was going on, it intrigued me. I kept putting files together, watching stories grow, watching new versions of the myths get created, and watching the last great American sports legend come to life. And that's how this story began.
Let me ask you kind of a nuts and bolts question. It's not all that often that I am exploring a book that has three co-authors. Could you just say a quick word about how you and Bill Dembski and Alex Thomas collaborated on this book? I mean, did you each play distinctive roles in the shaping of this book? Tell us more about your work as a three-man team in crafting this book together.
Each of us could have written this book, and each of us would have written a different book about what was going on. The advantage that we had was bringing three singular perspectives to light and having them melded into one story. And as you noted in your introduction, the objectification of Steve Dalkowski has gone on for decades. He has been exploited, abused, and lied about. This is a human story about a really fine pitcher, a really great guy, somebody that everybody liked. So we were able to bring three different perspectives together, and I think it strengthens the story, Greg.
One of the matters that I should think would be a fairly stern challenge is that we are talking about somebody who was kind of a legendary figure in a lot of different ways. And, of course, things get complicated when trying to tell the story of a legend like Steve Dalkowski. At one point in the book, I think it's in the foreword, these words are written: time and storytelling, myths and legends have blurred many of the facts in the decades since Dalkowski signed a minor league contract with the Orioles. I mean, those first few words really intrigue me because it sort of crystallizes the challenge that you and your co-authors faced in terms of trying to sort of pick apart the legend and kind of figure out where the real story was and what was sort of legend and myth that was sort of piled on top of it. How did you and your co-authors go about doing that? Or was that not one of your most important goals?
It was one of our most important goals. I mean, you've identified it. We wanted to distill the truth from the myth, the lies, the exaggerations, and the legends as best we could. We have to keep in mind that much of this happened 60 years ago. Many of the people who were participants in the story are no longer with us. Since we began writing the book 4 years ago, we've lost 8 more players and people who contributed to the book. It's very hard to distill it out. This Ted Williams story is a wonderful one. We have 13 different versions of the Ted Williams story. And it's intriguing that a guy like Ted Williams, if he faced Dalkowski, this never got mentioned in the media. I mean, Ted couldn't go to the barber shop without getting an article on the front page of the sports section. So it's interesting. So to distill it down and figure out where we were was part of the challenge. It was a wonderful piece. And I think that what we've distilled out, Greg, is something that family and friends of Dalco have to be very happy about. The truth is being told for perhaps the first time.
Another thing that I appreciate about the book, and I should hasten to add that I've never played baseball, and I will even be so honest as to say I'm not particularly a baseball fan. There are other sports that I enjoy a whole lot more as a spectator than baseball, but I really count among some of my favorite books ever written books about baseball and books about certain important baseball players. And one of the things that I really appreciate about this book is the way in which you really help those of us who have never been pitchers, which is most of us, understand some of the intricacies that are part of pitching. I want to have you just for a moment talk about something that you say early on in the book, and I'm assuming that this is maybe a part of the book where you had the most significant hand in kind of talking about the process of the baseball pitch. When you write these words, throwing strikes is a two-part process, and the physical piece is number two. Of course, a pitcher needs a repeatable delivery, but step one occurs in the pitcher's head before he throws. He must decide what pitch to throw, where to throw it, then have the conviction to throw it there. Can you tell us more about this two-part process that is really a part of every single baseball pitch that any pitcher ever throws? And maybe say a word about how you, as a baseball coach, pitching coach, need to kind of attack the process and help an athlete to improve in either one aspect or the other.
First of all, when we look at Steve Dalkowski, he lacked self-confidence. And in lacking self-confidence, he was running naked. You know, the mind is a dangerous place. It carries a lot of negatives that live rent-free in the head. Dalkowski was what? The hardest thrower of all time. Dalkowski was what? He should strike out everybody each time he goes to the hill. Dalkowski didn't have control. Every time Steve went to the mound, he was dragging all this stuff out there. Now, when it comes to mechanical pieces, Greg, it's very easy to say that we're going to fix somebody's mechanics. But that's the wrong piece of the puzzle. The timing that gets you from first forward movement to foot strike and release of ball is the first component. That then leads to how you're generating energy from the feet all the way up to the ball being released out of the hand, and the resulting piece is the mechanics. So if somebody monkeys with the mechanics, they're fooling with the wrong piece of the puzzle in the wrong order. Dalkowski had one mechanical issue that I'm confident I can identify. His glove was soft and out front of him, and it was running over toward third base. That's why the ball was high and low and directly over home plate. But Steve's real issues were mental, and I don't mean anything negative about Steve. He lacked self-confidence. He took a lot of baggage to the mound. He choked. Everybody chokes, Greg. It's not just Steve. We all do. It's thinking too much. He got out on the mound, and he was thinking too much. He cared too much about the game. He cared too much about the result rather than the process, and he cared too much about what other people thought. Consequently, he was never dealing with his own reality, and there was nobody. All well-intentioned people around him were trying hard, but nobody knew how to help him at that point in time. Mm-hmm. Today, we would know how to do that. When I work with a pitcher, first thing I have to do is establish trust between that individual and me. We have to establish a solid relationship that he trusts and understands what I'm doing and how I'm going to get it done. All of these are components on building it out.
We're speaking with Brian Vikander. He is one of three co-authors of a really interesting new book called Dalko, The Untold Story of Baseball's Fastest Pitcher. It is the story of Steve Dalkowski, who had tremendous talent and tremendous potential, but potential that was ultimately not fully realized. And Steve Dalkowski was never able to break into the major leagues. But he is a legend all the same, and his story is a fascinating one, told really well in this book. Your book explores his childhood and mentions, among other things, his connection with his own dad and some of his first teammates and coaches who worked with him. And it's important for us to note that even as a youngster, Steve Dalkowski was already apparently throwing really, really fast. What can we attribute that to? I mean, that even as a youngster, this was something that he was able to do.
Throwing hard is a God-given talent, Greg. There's no way to teach throwing hard. If you come to me and want to learn how to pitch better, I'll run a series of tests on you, and I'll say, Greg, you've got a 92 in the system. You're throwing 86 right now, so we're looking for 8%. And this is how we're going to find it. This is how we're going to get it done. I'll get you your 92. I won't get you a 93 because you don't have a 93 in there. So we're going to learn how to pitch and do something else. Dalkowski had a God-given talent. When Zeus was at the top of Olympus, he said, I'm going to give this guy a thunderbolt. This guy's going to bring it. And he was doing that from the time he was about 13 years of age and was known all over the place for being able to throw hard. Problem was, he didn't know where the ball was going, and nobody around him could help him understand how to pitch and how to create a repeatable delivery, both of which we'd be able to remedy today.
Hmm. The book talks about how he grew up in a household that really loved baseball and that really loved the Red Sox. And you tell us about all of the playing that the father and son did together. And you also tell us about a really special trip which the family made to Fenway Park on August 6, 1953, when Steve Dalkowski got to see a real legend, Ted Williams. Tell us what made this such a special moment in Steve Dalkowski's life.
Well, there were several things that are almost ironic here, aren't there? I mean, he got to go to a game with his dad and his sister. It was special to be able to go to a game. It wasn't a given that you got to spend that kind of money and do that in the Dalkowski household. They got to see Ted in his first game back from Korea. Here's a guy who spent almost 5 years of his prime time of his career, World War II in Korea, as a fighter pilot, and didn't get some of those additional at-bats. Ted wasn't really expected to play that day, and he was called upon to come in and pinch hit late in the game against the Orioles, ironically enough, who were the team that won the opportunity to put Steve in their system a couple of years later. And Steve got to see Ted Williams come up. He was facing a screwball pitcher, which is easy to put the ball on the ground. He didn't want to do that. He wanted to elevate it. The third pitch that he swung at, he nearly took out of the park. And then the next pitch, he got under just a little bit, popped it up. But it was family, opportunity to see a real baseball game, see one of the greatest players that ever played the game, and understand at later date. It was ironic that he saw them playing against the Orioles, and that's the organization that he was going to be involved with.
Hmm. Your book talks about how even as a young man, Steve Dalkowski was a very, very fast pitcher, and I thought it was really interesting how in many cases you would hear a Steve Dalkowski pitch more than you would actually be able to see it. You write, one instance the ball was in the pitcher's hand, and the next it was in the catcher's mitt with a loud, sharp crack like a gunshot. The only other evidence of its journey was a threatening sound that people close to the plate could hear. The ball sizzled as it split the air. One spectator said it buzzed like a bee. Another said it sounded like cloth ripping. Whatever it was, the ominous noise made each hitter's trip to the plate even more intimidating. Batters could hear Steve Dalkowski's fastball, but they couldn't see it, and they certainly couldn't hit it. I mean, that tells us a lot, and you're not even describing his pitching at the apex of his career. You're talking about him as still in high school at this point, but apparently able to do this kind of thing.
He could bring it. There's no doubt about it. And each one of us has had an opportunity at whatever level we played. There was always somebody who threw hard, and the stories about that person continued to grow and what was happening. Dalko could really, really bring it. And when he worked with pitchers, there's a sound, Greg, that between 91, 94, there's a sound, 95 to 97, 98, different sound, 98 to 100, 101 sound. You go up above that, there's another sound. And each level of these sounds is threatening. Like when you're laying on the beach and you're almost asleep, enjoying that sunshine, a bee comes around, boy, it brings you right out of your hibernation. You're attentive. And I got news for you. That's what Dalko was doing. Hmm. So people were being threatened, not just by visual acuity. Their other senses were heightened when they crawled into the batter's box, and they weren't thinking about being an aggressive hitter. They were thinking about getting back to the dugout safely. That's what they were thinking about. And that's an issue that, had Dalko understood, truly understood what that meant and put it to his good use, it would have been tremendously valuable to him in becoming a better pitcher, not simply the hardest thrower, but a better pitcher.
Right. You tell us that as he was approaching the age of 17, you write, his devastating fastball was off the charts, but he was still nowhere near the strike zone much of the time. The biggest problem was the way the ball appeared to rise uncontrollably on its way to the plate. And as you're describing this, you quote somebody who served as Steve Delkovsky's catcher during his sophomore year, somebody named Lenny Pear. And I'm not sure if he's still alive and you had the chance to speak with him directly or if this is something he recounted later in some kind of an interview. But it's really interesting to think that we can hear from the someone who caught some of these fastballs from Steve Delkovsky and a catcher who was astute enough to see the problem and who tried to do what he could to try to get this shortcoming corrected to no avail, unfortunately.
Well, it is. We did not have a chance to speak to Len. He had passed on, but we did take that quote from somewhere else. And it raises a tremendously interesting point about a rising fastball. No one who ever saw Delco pitch said his ball did not rise. Everybody said it rose so much it would go over the head of the catcher, sometimes hit an umpire, sometimes just go straight to the screen. We've never been able to ascertain what is the level at which a baseball would have to be thrown to get it to rise. It would rise at some point, Greg. We simply don't know what it is. Now, if the physics department at the University of Chicago comes back and tells us it's 718 miles an hour, well, we know that his fastball could not have risen. However, if they came back and said it was 117, we'd have an entirely different story to take a look at, wouldn't we? You got guys like Hall of Famers, great frontline guys like Davey Johnson, who have seen Delkovsky pitch, and every single one of them swears the ball rose 3 feet. That's remarkable stuff. And you wonder, what were they looking at? And not all these guys are making that story up.
We're speaking with Brian Vikander about the book he co-authored called Delco, The Untold Story of Baseball's Fastest Pitcher. Baseball's fastest pitcher was the one and only Steve Delkovsky, who never managed to crack into the major leagues, but in the minor leagues, and even in the years before he made it into professional baseball, Steve Delkovsky was a legend for how fast he could throw. It's interesting. You tell us that just to look at him, he was a very ordinary-looking guy. I mean, not a striking physical specimen, but he was a consummate natural athlete. And I think one of the most interesting aspects of his story, which you explore in the third chapter of your book, is the fact that he was also a wonderful football player. And in many respects, he was far more successful on the gridiron than he was on the baseball diamond. I mean, and particularly when it came to matters like consistent success. That's where, in some ways, he really shone the most brightly. Tell us about Steve Delkovsky, the football player, and what you think was key to his success in football and why that could not, in a sense, transfer over to the baseball diamond and make him a more consistently successful baseball pitcher.
Steve had a wonderful football career, leading his New Britain High teammates to two consecutive state championships. He was a consummate athlete in that game. Now, why? The why is simple. In a football game, you got 22 guys who are actively involved and have something to do on every single play, don't they? You're not isolated out there on the mound. And that's the difference. Steve was part of the team. And while he may have been the star of the team, he was still surrounded by the team at all times. That's not what happens when you take the hill. When you take the hill in baseball, nobody's watching the right fielder scratch his ear. They're watching the guy on the mound. And if something doesn't go right on the mound, the whole stadium will let the pitcher know what's going on. That was exactly the problem that Steve had as part of his issues. He was alone. He was isolated. And that loneliness exacerbated all of the problems that he had on the hill. And that's, again, something, Greg, we could have and would have been able to remedy today.
Mm. I want to just read the one of the last paragraphs of this fascinating chapter, which speaks to exactly what you were saying. While the pitcher has the support of eight teammates, each with a crucial responsibility, Power pitchers such as Delkowski rarely consider using their 9-to-1 odds. They simply bring the heat. Pitchers routinely face lonely pressure. But when lonely pressure morphs into forbidding isolation, a pitcher can lose his focus and concentration. He might then start ruminating about the last pitch he threw or how the next one might cost him the game. He can't control or affect those scenarios. He can only control the pitch leaving his hand at the moment. A case of nerves can be his downfall. If he gets distracted by past results or future possibilities, if he lets self-doubt creep in, if he stops concentrating on the process of focusing on this pitch, he'll soon be in trouble and on his way to an early shower. One of the things you've said repeatedly in this interview is that when it comes to the mental aspect of pitching, Steve Delkowski could be helped if he were with us today. That is, baseball, and in particular professional baseball, has certain tools at its disposal that simply weren't a part of the landscape back in the late 1950s into the early 1960s. Tell us more about the way in which we know things now about this aspect of the game that could have perhaps been a very tangible help to Steve Delkowski.
Well, it goes back to simplifying the game for him a little bit. You know, he needed to slow down. He needed to breathe. He needed to focus. I work with pitchers in a way that I will take visual acuity out of the equation, Greg, and have these guys, after a period of time, throwing from the stretch position, full 60 feet away, and throwing with their eyes closed. Now they're embracing all four senses in a way that they've never encountered before, and yet when they get to the end of it, they can tell me exactly where that pitch went. Now this is sort of advanced, but let's take a couple of simple things. We know that 50% of all hitters take the first pitch, okay? How many guys do you think took the first pitch when Delco was throwing? Well, I'll bet the number was higher than 50%. In fact, you had more guys in the other dugout being told by the manager, I don't want you just taking the first pitch. I want you to take every pitch until he throws a strike. Okay. We know also that major league hitters on 0-0 curveballs hit 0-67. That's 1 for 20. That's called you're on your way to rookie league. You ain't going to Cooperstown with those kind of numbers. Now, if somebody had shared this information with Steve, letting him know that nobody's digging in, nobody has their heart in taking a cut, and he had gotten to the point of throwing strike one, thus pitching ahead, he would have been in an entirely different circumstance throughout his entire career. And if he had understood, when you're behind in the count, pitch to contact, 9-to-1 odds. Greg, you and I go to Vegas with 9-to-1 odds, we'll argue about one thing, baby. It'll be the size of the U-Haul to bring all the cash home. There's not going to be anything else we talk about. And then he needed to focus on the next pitch, rather than ruminating over what just occurred and then projecting into the future. There's nothing you can do about the past and the future. You got to get into the now moment, and that's pivotal, particularly for a pitcher. It is for a hitter and anybody who's playing professional sport, but pitcher, you can't take that much time and get outside it. You're in a game, you're throwing well, everything's going great for you, you're dealing, you're handling the other team, and you throw one pitch that's way outside the zone. You dismiss it, don't think it's a big deal. You throw another one that catches a little too much of the plate, double into right center, you got a runner on second. Now you've changed the defense, you've changed the configuration of the game, and you didn't realize what happened on two pitches earlier was really what the problem was, and you should have had the acumen to fix it at that point in time, not hope that something got better. And Steve was in too much of a hope and pray mode about, I hope this gets better. I hope I get this thing over. I hope I don't hit this guy. I hope I don't walk this guy. I hope I strike this guy out. He was in that mode. You can't operate in that mode, Greg. It's that simple.
What's interesting to me is that professional baseball was really interested in Steve Delkowski, even given his inconsistency, his wild inconsistency. So apparently those who saw him pitch believed that they were going to be able to, in a sense, tame him or guide him shape him into being a successful professional baseball pitcher. I mean, did they have good reason to be confident about that? I mean, given the fact that now in it with retrospect being 2020, hindsight being 2020, we know now that they didn't have any of the tools that really would have perhaps helped Steve Delkowski. But was it a common thing back then to see somebody with tremendous raw talent and to be able to shape them into a successful player?
It certainly was. And let's take it back to 1950s thinking. The thinking back then was, this guy has a once-in-a-lifetime arm, period. All right, that's worth a little bit of a gamble. This is not just an ordinary arm. This is an arm the likes of which we've never seen the equivalency, period, okay? Now, let's take a look at guys like Ryan the Flame Duren, who was so effective for the Yankees 58 through 1960. He could bring it to it. It took him about 6 or 7 years to get to the point that he finally found the strike zone and was going. Ever heard of Sandy Koufax? His first 6 years in the major leagues, he had a wonderful record, 36 wins, 40 losses. The next year, 6 years in the major leagues, he went 1-29-47. He found it. No, there was a template out there that at some point in time, these guys would get it. But each of these guys, hard throwers don't want to throw the slow ball. You ever go to a baseball game, Greg, you never hear, slow it down. No, it's speed it up. Throw the heat. Blow it by him. Strike him out. Give him the gas. Nobody talks about the slow ball that keeps him off your fastball mistakes. Koufax learned that he didn't have to strike everybody out. Koufax learned that he could use the team behind him. Yes, he was still throwing hard. And so was Duren. So was Herb Score. So was Rex Barney. All these guys. There are not many guys. Bobby Feller came into professional baseball throwing hard, and he knew where the strike zone was. But Nolan Ryan had a start that wasn't exactly perfect back in the late 60s with the Mets, then moving along to the Angels. It took him a while. So, yes, there was a template to say that at a point in time, everybody will figure this out, right? No, not everybody. And Steve didn't. And, again, it was because of what was going on between his ears. He was not self-confident. He was not able to project into staying in the now, the present moment, rather than being in the past or the future.
We're speaking with Brian Vikander about his book, Dalco, The Untold Story of Baseball's Fastest Pitcher, one Steve Delkowski. One thing that is really interesting to read about is the efforts made in 1958 to scientifically measure the speed of the pitches of, for instance, the great Bob Feller. And shortly thereafter, somebody gets the idea of trying to scientifically measure the pitching, the fastball, of young Steve Delkowski, just a minor leaguer, but someone that, of course, many believed was destined for incredibly great things. Tell our listeners a little bit about this attempt to scientifically measure the pitching of Steve Delkowski, and also some of the question marks and or controversy that surrounded this effort.
It's an interesting story. They took him to the Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland to see if they could test the speed of Steve's fastball using military equipment that was measuring the speed of shells, military shells, incoming and outgoing kinds of shells. They set Steve up. They had him pitch, and he came back with a whopping 85.8 reading, which is absolutely impossible. It couldn't possibly. I mean, I used to almost throw that hard a couple of years ago, and it's not possible Dalco was doing that. So at the close of the situation in Aberdeen, they thought that maybe because they were doing this in the middle of the day, the cells had been affected by the direct sunlight and caused the readings to be off. The other thing they thought was perhaps Dalco was simply trying to lay it in there, realizing he had control problems. He didn't want to be hitting the truck with the equipment or killing one of the people who's standing over there with a clipboard. Maybe he was just trying to lay it in there, Greg. We don't have the answer. There's nobody alive that we have that we can talk to about that. And so we just don't know. But we know the reading is not accurate. And the reading grew out, too. Once the story was done, typically he's throwing 98.6 and upwards of close to 100 miles an hour as people morph the story into something else. But it was a tremendously low reading that simply couldn't have been accurate. There's nobody in baseball who would be scared of an 86-mile-an-hour fastball, period. That's BP. So the test was not accurate, and there was nothing more that they could do to come up with greater accuracy about what his velocity really was.
Hmm. This prompts a question I hadn't thought I was even going to ask, but the question is there any film footage that survives of Steve Delkowski pitching, which allows a pitching expert like yourself, for instance, to examine in order to really understand what was going on with his pitching?
There you've got one of the great mysteries of all time. Every major league organization in the 50s and early 60s, when we had 16 teams in the majors, went to spring training. They filmed all of the stars, the 25 players that everybody, every fan would know, and they would film high-level prospects. Certainly Delkowski would have fit into that. So they'd all get that kind of footage out there. They used it in PR to sell tickets and whatnot. The only guy that there is no film on is Delkowski. Now, how could that possibly be, Craig? You're talking about a once-in-a-lifetime arm. They filmed Barber. They filmed Bo Bielinski. They filmed all kinds of guys, everybody else, but not him. We don't know what the answer to that is. And we hope that we'll find it one day. You know, through our website, dalcobook.com, we're going to continue to put up stories and track down new leads and what's going on. Now, having contacted the Orioles organization, when they moved to Camden Yards, they jettisoned all kinds of archival material that they had at the old ballpark. Some was given to the Babe Ruth Museum in Baltimore, and the rest was simply thrown out. Did Dalco go into that? We don't know. And you're absolutely right. If we had some film on Delkowski, we'd be able to put some science to determining just exactly how hard he threw. We couldn't even get enough still photographs. Now, if I had still photographs of Steve pitching with different parts of his mechanical process to look at where he was or what was going on, I could at least advance a theory on what I suspect was occurring. We don't even have enough footage to be able to talk about him from his balance and posture point through to his separate and rotate to get to his release point. We don't even have those. We do have one photograph, however, that looks tremendously like the transformed Sandy Koufax in 1962, leading with his hip. And I'll tell you what, you take the heads off and the uniform off, and you look at which one, you wouldn't know which one was Dalco and which one was Koufax. So it is amazing there's no film, and we do hope that one day it will surface.
One thing we have not yet talked about, and it's important for us to talk about it, is a bit about Steve Delkowski as a person. I mean, for instance, what his personality was like. And I think it's important for us to kind of understand this, because sometimes when we hear about somebody who is brilliantly talented but does not fulfill their potential, we sometimes fill in the spaces and jump to conclusions that this was a hotshot who thought he was better than he was and, you know, was uncoachable or not receptive or whatever. And this does not seem to be the case with Steve Delkowski, that he was, for all his talent, was perhaps a fairly humble guy and a friendly guy and so on. Tell us more about him as a person, as a personality.
Steve was loved by everybody who came across him, Greg. That goes back to his high school teammates, the people in the community of New Britain. It goes to all of his teammates that he played with over the years. They respected him. It goes to the coaching staffs and the managers that he worked with over that period of time. He was loved by everybody. He was a good guy. He was never cocky and had reason to be, but he didn't do that. He never took that. He lacked self-confidence, and because he lacked self-confidence, he let himself down some dangerous roads. He didn't have a positive distraction outside of baseball that he could zero in on. and it led him to problems in the both in his baseball life and certainly after he left baseball. But there's not one account of people saying bad things about Steve Dalkowski. Everybody loved the guy. He borrowed money from the teammates. He'd get his check on Friday, and he'd go down the line and pay everybody back. He was simply a good guy. They looked up to him. They really liked him as a teammate. Great human being.
It was a little shocking to read that Steve Dalkowski, perhaps as a teenager, was already on his way to becoming an alcoholic. And this is a part of the story which ties us back to Steve Dalkowski's own father. Tell us more about this issue, how early it became evident, and what kind of a role that it played during Steve Dalkowski's professional baseball career.
Well, takes you to a working class community, and I'm not denigrating anybody by using the term, but people worked hard, and then when Friday night came around, the guys would get together at the local bar and joke and drink, and it was part of the culture, okay? Again, I'm not judging anybody by saying that. I don't want that misunderstood, but it was part of the culture, and his father took Steve out, and he was drinking with Steve. Now, different cultures do that. You know, I grew up in Australia, and my grandfather and uncle would give me a glass of beer as a young boy once in a while. I wasn't getting hammered. It was a little glass. It wasn't a giant, 48-ounce tumbler. So cultures will change in what was going on. But Steve did find, I believe, that he could drink and still go out and perform very, very well. And as he got into the minor leagues, he was, let's say, a functional alcoholic. He was able to go out, do his drinking, and get prepared for the game and continue to do what he needed to do to try and improve his lot in the minor league system. And he did do that. Now, there's a collective impact of that drinking, and perhaps that begins to show up in the early 60s, and he's drinking a little more, a little too much. It may be impacting his play on the field a little bit. We can't be sure about all those. Once he left baseball, however, once he realized that Zeus had taken back the Thunderbolt, his life really started to deteriorate. Again, he didn't have a positive distraction outside baseball. Wasn't interested in intellectual pursuits. He didn't like doing anything on going to the bars and drinking. If he'd had a positive distraction of some kind, perhaps that would have changed where Steve ended up. We don't know for sure.
I think a really interesting point is made in the book's foreword, which is written by a fine pitcher himself, nicknamed Sudden Sam McDowell. And in his foreword, he says something about how Steve Dalkowski was a pitching legend in an era when instant news did not exist. And I think this is something that would easily be lost on us if it were not pointed out, that Steve Dalkowski did what he did in a world very, very different from the world we live in today, and particularly different when it comes to the matter of dissemination of news. And so it probably says something about the legendary status that he achieved at this point in time. Tell us more about what you think is important in terms of when Steve Dalkowski rose to the prominence that he enjoyed. How does that kind of change the story of the level of his legend?
Well, it comes down to that. This is really the journey of the hero, isn't it? I mean, this goes back to time immemorial. The hero departs, the hero fulfills, the hero returns, and that's what everybody expected from Steve and what was going on. However, as things went along, he departed. The fulfillment never really came in the way that he had hoped. What happened instead is the legends continued to grow. Now, he went to minor league baseball. His rep was already established. Everybody knew this guy could bring it, that he had a lethal fastball. This was not just a regular dude coming to pitch, and he threw sort of hard. And every story continued to grow. Now, this goes back to times in Little League, Greg. I mean, we all hear about somebody who can throw hard. And when I grew up in the 50s and 60s and playing baseball at that period of time, we built on the stories. But, you know, there's this guy out there by the name of Greg Berg really throws hard. And I heard that he threw a pitch in and it broke somebody's bat in half. Guy didn't even get a swing at it, you know. And then all of a sudden, yeah, he went and got another bat and he threw another pitch. He broke a second bat. Well, that's how this stuff morphed. And so all of a sudden, Steve, who was lacking self-confidence, was living as a legend. The hero was no longer Steve anymore. It became what he had been objectified into. He was no longer a subject. He was no longer a human being. He had been turned into something totally different that he now alternately had to live up to, along with all of the other stuff that I mentioned he had to take to the mound with him every time he pitched.
Mm-hmm. That's what I meant at the top when I said that this is a deeply affecting human story, not just a baseball story. And that's why I think even if someone is not particularly interested in the game of baseball, this is still a story that is very much worth telling. And I think you and your co-authors have done an absolutely terrific job of bringing this this figure really vividly to life, even after all of this time, and even though, in a sense, it is a story that played out maybe a little longer ago than a modern-day historian would want. I mean, I'm sure there are all kinds of things that you wish were at your disposal in order to tell this story even more fully.
That's absolutely true, Greg. I wish that we had been able to start this book perhaps in the middle 80s. That's, we would have had all of these guys alive. We would have talked to Weaver. We would have talked to his catchers. We would have had hundreds and hundreds of teammates that he played with and opposing players that we would have had the opportunity to interview, and we didn't do that. I mentioned at the top of this that we've lost eight guys since we started the book 4 years ago, and that's tough. I really appreciate the nice things you said about the human story. We were notified last week that we have been nominated for the Casey Award, which is the top award honored by a book about baseball in a given year. So 10 books have been nominated. We're grateful to be part of that group and hopeful that maybe the good intentions will continue. But we're happy to be in that group and telling a story that no one really had the truth on prior to this articulation.
Mm. The book again is Dalco, The Untold Story of Baseball's Fastest Pitcher. And that fastest pitcher, Steve Dalkowski. Co-authored by Bill Demski, Alex Thomas, and my morning show guest, Brian Vikander. The book published by Influence Publishers. Brian Vikander, thank you so much for joining me today on the morning show to talk about your fascinating book. And best wishes to you.
Thank you very much, Greg. Thanks for all the opportunity here. I appreciate it. We appreciate it.
Next week, a very exciting lineup of morning shows, beginning on Monday with local cartoonist John Hambrock, creator of the wonderful comic strip The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee. This comic strip is about to begin its 15th year of national syndication, and we'll celebrate the anniversary with John Hambrock on Monday's morning show. On Tuesday, we're joined by Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, for his monthly visit to the program. On Wednesday, I'll speak with two colleagues from Carthage College, Jeff Roberg from Political Science and John Bruning from Communication Digital Media. They have team taught once again a class called Elections and Campaigns. And of course, we'll look back at this tumultuous presidential campaign and its tumultuous aftermath with Professors Roberg and Bruning on Wednesday. On Thursday, I speak with best-selling author Tim Weiner about his intriguing and hard-hitting book, The Folly and the Glory, America, Russia, and Political Warfare, 1945 to 2020. And 1 week from today, interviews with several different people who have had to directly, personally contend with COVID-19, including a frontline worker, a nurse who contracted COVID-19, a local elected official, and a couple of different college students, one of which remains completely asymptomatic. several different perspectives on COVID-19 1 week from today. And we remind you that the morning show is not only broadcast Monday through Friday over WGTD, but available 7 days a week as a podcast. Be sure to look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911, now reopened for in-store shopping Tuesdays and Thursdays and Fridays 11 till 5 and Saturdays from 10 to 4. Don't forget your mask. And you can still shop online at jackandrea.com. We're approaching 9 o'clock.